There was a very strict monastery where the gentlemen who were the monks there in that monastery had to keep complete and total silence. They were supposed to always be praying or carrying out their chores, but they couldn't talk to one another about it. Once each year, those monks were given an opportunity to meet with the abbot, the father superior of the monastery. But even then, they were only allowed to speak two words, just two words a year. A new young buck entered that monastery, and he found it quite difficult to adjust to the rigorous prayer life and all the hard chores, but especially not being able to talk to anybody or even to call home. And yet, as the days ticked by, weeks became months, and finally, it was the end of the first year. And the young monk was welcomed into Father Superior's office, who said to him, "What have you to say for yourself, my child?" To which the monk responded, "Bed hard." That was it. Two words. He chose them carefully. He went back to his cell. He continued to pray. He continued to obey. It wasn't really getting any easier. He wasn't having a better time of it. And then year number two comes to an end, and he had to think very carefully, what two words will I say this time? And Father Superior welcomed him into his office and said, "What have you to say to me, my child?" And he said, "Food bad." Another complaint. Food bad, bed hard. That's it. Four words in 2 years. Well, he had pretty much had it by then. And so at the end of the third year, when he came into Father Superior's office, he had with him the same bag that he brought with him when he arrived there. And Father Superior said to him, "What is it this time?" And he said, "I quit." Father Superior said, "That doesn't surprise me. All you've done since you got here is complain." And I think God and Moses probably felt the same way about all those Hebrews that crossed the Red Sea on dry ground, out of Egypt, into the desert of sin, on their way to the promised land of Canaan, flowing with milk and honey. God had given them everything, including their life, and now he is giving them their freedom. They had seen all the mighty deeds that he wrought against the Egyptians to help them win their freedom. And now, as soon as they're out in that desert, they stop trusting and they start complaining. Much like children on our annual summer road trips, they want to say, "Are we there yet? Are we there yet? I have to go to the bathroom." Much to the chagrin of their parents, God and Moses were both becoming quite upset with how much these people refused to just let it be, refused to just trust that God, if he had a plan to get them out of Egypt, certainly has a plan to get them through the desert. But they've already been complaining about how hot it is during the day, how cold it is at night, that they have nothing to drink, they have nothing to eat. And then, showing just how low they can go, now they tell Moses, "We were better off as slaves." At least then they had a bed to sleep in, and they knew where their next meal was coming from. God has answered their prayer. He has come to set them free, but they don't like how he's doing it, and so now they regret asking for that freedom in the first place. They'd rather be put back in chains. Later in the Exodus story, we'll see that both God and Moses lose patience with those Hebrews and begin to punish them for their complaints. But at this time, their objections are being met with mercy, not wrath. When they're thirsty, God will give them water from the rock in the next chapter. And here, God is going to give them manna, heavenly bread, to remind them they're only going to get through that desert if they depend on him. That's the only way they got out of Egypt, and it's the only way they got onto this planet in the first place, by trusting in him, because everything comes from God. Everything belongs to God, and everything should be used to give God glory and honor and praise. We hear in the book of Exodus just how many people crossed that Red Sea. The book tells us it's 600,000, but it only mentions the men. They didn't travel alone. They've got their women and children with them. It's millions of people have gone out into the desert. It's millions of people that God is going to feed every day with that manna, that heavenly bread. Now, truth be told, that journey through the desert should only have taken 40 days, not 40 years, unless they were going to be walking at an incredibly slow pace. But the reason why the 40-day journey became a 40-year exodus, God kept them wandering around in circles, just waiting for that one moment when they might finally set aside their complaints and their grumblings and trust in him and let him and Moses lead them where they are supposed to be. As they're wandering around in circles and God continues to give them that bread, notice it's daily bread. They had to go collect it every day. They couldn't hoard it. They couldn't fill their pantries with it. And to make sure they couldn't, God would make it rot every night so they'd have to turn to him again the very next day. When Jesus taught us to pray, he taught us to ask for the same thing, daily bread, that we must depend on him every day for everything we have and every blessing, and he continues to provide. As he fed millions in the desert, today he feeds billions with the Eucharist. And that's just his nature, to continue to feed his lambs and to guide them and gather them though they wander until one day we hope to graze in heavenly pastures. But just as Moses was encountering Israel's grumbling and complaining against God, Jesus had also some dispute and debate with his disciples in the gospel today. We're still in the sixth chapter of John. We started it last week. We have three more weeks to go after today. Last week was the loaves and the fishes, where Jesus was able to take five pieces of bread and two sardines and feed tens of thousands of people. And not just a nibble, they had their fill, and then there were still 12 baskets left over. That's a pretty great miracle. But now it's the next day. And those same people have followed Jesus to the other shores of the Sea of Galilee, and they want him to perform a sign for them. What sign can you do for us, they ask. What sign can you do for us to prove to us that you are the Messiah, the Son of God? Jesus says, say what? You just saw the loaves and fishes, how I was able to feed so many with so few, how the meager in my hands becomes miraculous. But that wasn't the only miracle in John chapter 6. We're missing some verses between last Sunday's gospel and today. And in the intervening verses, the very night to the loaves and fishes, when Jesus chooses to go from one side of the Sea of Galilee to the other, he doesn't take the long way around on foot, and he doesn't get into a boat. Instead, he walks on the water, and it's witnessed by countless people, all of whom are terrified, including the apostles. And yet then there's another miracle, because even though that boat was 4 miles from this shore and 4 miles from that shore, immediately that boat comes to the shore because Jesus wills it to be so. Already in this chapter, thousands are fed. Jesus walks on water. He's moving boats around miles at a time. And yet still, they're asking for a sign. Let that be a lesson to us. How many times do we pray? Do we tell God that we need a sign? Somebody's sick. I'm not doing too well either. I need a sign, God, that you are real, that you care, that you'll do something about this. I need that promotion. I need an A on the test I didn't study for. I need to win the race I didn't train for, whatever the case may be. God, prove yourself to me. That's basically what Israel wanted from God in the desert. That's what Jesus' disciples wanted from him by the shores of the Sea of Galilee. And people have been demanding signs ever since. But that is a lack of faith, not an act of faith. If we truly believed in God, he would not have to do anything to get our attention or to attract our faith. We'd give it freely, we'd give it completely, and we would give it always, whether things were going well or whether the wind was always against our boat with waves crashing in. We would trust in him and believe in him, because he is God and we are not, because he is God and we are his, because he is God and he is good. But instead, we all want to see the burning bush. We all want the flashing neon sign that tells us what to do. But be careful, because if God gave you such a sign about what you are supposed to do, would you actually do it? Perhaps not. Instead, we would then tell God how we need a different plan. We would tell him how he'd be a better God and a more merciful God and a kinder God if only he would do things our way instead of his way. But in that same prayer that Jesus taught us when we asked for daily bread, what else did we say? Maybe we should think about it more often. Thy will be done, yours, not mine. In that sense, then, he is God, and he is not our enemy. God will always be on your side. Even when you feel you're on a cross, he'll be hanging on one right beside you. He gives us the bread from heaven. He does it so he can save us, so he can forgive us, so he can show his love for us. And he doesn't want us to remain in the desert. He wants us all to be with him in the promised land. But we'll continue wandering in circles until we learn to trust in him.